Just one thing before we do jump into today's show, and that is my Beyond the Game newsletter. Would you enjoy getting a short email from me every Friday that provides something to stoke your curiosity before the sporting weekend? Hundreds of parents, coaches, and community sport leaders subscribe to my free newsletter called Beyond the Game. Basically, it includes a short insight from me that I've been pondering during the week, a key finding from the latest research I've been reading, as well as a cool idea from one of the inspiring minds who come on this podcast. It's all designed to help you support your athletes to be the very best that they can be. So if that sounds fun, again, it's very short, just a little goodness before you dive into your busy weekend of sport. If you'd like to try it out, just head over to athletedevelopmentproject.com/newsletter. Type in your email and you'll get the very next one. Cool. Thanks for listening. Kia ora and welcome to the Athlete Development Show podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Craig Harrison, sports scientist, coach, and researcher focused on the developing athlete. This week's conversation is with Zane Winslade. Zane is the owner of Flow Sport Mental Performance Coaching and works with athletes from youth to the elite level across multiple codes. Zane has a bachelor's degree in sports and leisure studies, a graduate diploma in teaching, and a master's degree in sports psychology from John F. Kennedy University. On the show today, Zane shares how he works with young people to help them manage their mind and perform as their best self. We also discuss the three key principles that underpin Zane's mental toughness journal for young athletes. We start the episode talking about how Zane approaches his own mental game at Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Enjoy. Zane, welcome to the show, mate.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So we were chatting just before we came on and you were telling me about some Jiu-Jitsu training that you've just come home from. And some of the interesting elements of that particular environment that gets you thinking. So I'd love to just dive into that and what comes to mind straight off the bat.
Yeah, and I sort of speaking and I can feel that my muscles are still pretty sore. I've had some pretty strong guys pinning me to the floor and tucked into their armpits and all sorts of positions. But I've been doing it for about 4 years and I really like, because I played so many different sports when I was young, and I really like the sort of approach to jiu-jitsu, and I hope it doesn't change because it's very traditionally based on the sparring, and even like the terminology that they use. We'll do sort of the warm-up and then we'll do, you know, some technical tactical stuff, and then they'll say, right, now it's time for training. And training is literally just playing, like, you know, full-on like sparring. So you send the training is the playing of it, which is kind of just a subtle little change in how what you're used to when you sport. You're like, oh, let's do the training and now play. And I really like that element of it. It's just been really interesting as I've, you know, over 4 years developed, probably a lot slower than I would have if I'd taken it up younger, but developed like skills, movement-based stuff, just intuitively, implicitly through the sparring. Which, you know, some people are sort of unconscious of, but you've realized like, oh, I know that I need to move like this because I know that if he gets me in this position, then I'm in trouble. So, you know, there's all these sort of instinctive things that you learn through that, which is just so cool and so neglected, I think, by other sports. We kind of like, well, but we need to do the training, which is like learn all the skills and the techniques and all that, but like there's so much happening in movement and perception and all that, eh? And I just love it. It's like, right. I mean, I'm probably a little bit biased. I'm like, oh, yes, do the technical stuff. And I was like, I just want to play. I just want to muck around and try and, you know, strangle this guy or whatever. It sounds rough, but it's ultimately just playing around and learning like that.
Yeah. So have you got a specific example that you can talk to? I mean, it resonates with me because of what it is. It's essentially a whole bunch of problems that you're trying to solve, isn't it? And
based on the perceptions of your environment and then the reactions of the body and the way that it has to move, you get to try and solve those problems in a really playful way, which funnily enough is not only super engaging, but there's lots of new skill acquisition science that backs that up. Have you got a particular example when it comes to a movement skill or something that you can talk to and have reflected on, say, hey, like, I really learned that today, but I didn't really understand it at the time, that that was specifically what we were working towards?
Yeah, well, and even, like, I guess just I individually coming up with a solution, like you say, to a problem that's there, like, I sort of recruited, a skill from when I played rugby, and I'm there standing and there's someone who's kind of got their legs sort of half sort of wrapped around mine, you know, which we'd call like guard, but I'm standing, so they don't quite have me locked in, and sort of putting one foot forward and then almost spinning, like you would spin out of a tackle, and spinning around. And that came about like, just like, oh, I wonder if I do this, what will happen? And then you go and do it and go, oh, that worked. And I do it every time, you know, when against people who are unaware. And yeah, I think it's probably one of the techniques. But for me, I learned it because I was just like, this is a problem. What could I do? Oh, we'll try this. And I had the freedom, because you have that freedom in the way that that's delivered, to try those things. And then they're stuck, and they probably stick a bit better than the prescribed stuff. Although, you know, I think I've learnt jiu-jitsu from doing some drills and then trying them and they worked. I've also learned from just like watching somebody else do something and going, I'm going to try that, and it seemed to stick and work for my body and the situations. And then I've learned just purely experimentally, like that, like discoveries type learning. So I like that. You know, those opportunities are there.
Those movement solutions that you come up with, how do you think about, you know, your formative years and how they contribute to the ability to do that now? You mentioned rugby and some skills that you learned through that medium.
Yeah, I'd imagine that probably for me, having played, you know, literally as much sports as I could through high school. So you'd probably know the science behind that. But I feel like there's a lot of like movement stuff to recruit and to try and available to me through that, I'd imagine. And definitely, obviously, there's the rugby crossover because it's a physical sport and it's, you know, it's full contact. There's lots of stuff there that transfer. So there's the direct stuff, but like I did, yeah. I mean, I played racket sports, and I still play a bit of golf. I played a lot of cricket. Did the athletic stuff. Did the running. All sorts. Did a bit of wrestling, obviously, directly with transfer. So, yeah.
Yeah, awesome. It sounds like there's a bit of rotational movements in your history as well, which I would assume. And I don't know jiu-jitsu very well, but that ability to rotate, if I'm watching it, I'm seeing it a lot, to be able to hold strong positions and then rotate.
Yeah. You're sort of shifting your weight to us, you know, if they're putting their... they're attacking you from one direction and you can rotate around, you know, sort of moving to you're deflecting their weight as it's coming towards you and moving around them, I guess, in some way. Yeah, probably not the best words to describe it.
No, it makes sense. Is there anything from a specific needs point of view that you've identified you need to work on in order to raise your game, so to speak? Like, would you come home and say, hey, I was pretty crap at that today, or I'm really lacking in this particular area of the sport and I need to really double down on that? Or is it just about playing more in general?
Yeah, I mean, occasionally I do. I'm just not that concerned with getting better, really. I mean, we want to get better at things. I guess I'm probably just a bit lazy with it. Like, okay, turn up and train, and then don't think too much about it. It's mostly for the fitness, bit of obviously learning, skill learning, and the social side as well. So it's kind of like,
right,
I should I do actually want to compete, just to sort of get those competitive juices going again. And, you know, considering like I work with athletes who put themselves out there, I always think it's good to put myself out there and do something. It's a bit scary as well. So,
yeah, interesting. Like, I'm almost hearing that there's a social conditioning there. Do you feel like you're falling into that? This is a sport, and I've been here long enough. I need to go and compete now. Is it okay just to turn up and sweat a little bit and laugh with your mates?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Yeah. I think that there's part of you, I guess, for better or worse, that you feel like competition is a measuring sort of a way to measure for you, like, where am I? How am I doing? Am I better? Unfortunately, it's probably not a good measure because outcomes aren't necessarily the best measure for those. But, you know, like, it feels like you can sort of see where you're at and test your skills and feel like they're getting better and that sort of thing. So there's that part of it. And then, like you say, socially, you feel like, oh, well, I'm getting better now. Got a test. Time to get into the arena, so to speak.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, Zane, you spend a whole bunch of time helping athletes with their mental game. What about for you? And you mentioned you think it's a good thing to do some things that are scary and walk the walk, so to speak. How do you think about your mental game going into a training or a sparring session in jiu-jitsu?
Well, I just think it's important to feel those things, but it doesn't have to be me competing in sport. It's just testing yourself in ways that are meaningful to you, so that you know, you're moving towards a like valued, you know, meaningful life. Hey, like, you're doing things that are important, and by sort of nature of the fact that they're important to you, they're probably going to bring up a bit of pressure, maybe a bit of fear, maybe, you know, some of that stuff. And it's important that, I think, not just me, but everyone's doing that. And I would always talk to clients openly, not too much self-disclosure, but, like, you know, like, I'm climbing my mountain, they're climbing theirs, and I'm not the Dalai Lama, and, you know, so like having situations where I stuff up, and that can be quite good. And especially like doing workshops with groups and things, I might start with, you know, like, I went to this jiu-jitsu competition, and, you know, I was so nervous and blah, 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 and I let that sort of get on top of me, or whatever. I'm trying to make up an example that hasn't happened, but, like, those are great, because if you can just show, like, hey, this is part of living and part of being a human, and that's okay. And yeah, I'm really conscious of just, I don't want to ever be the guy who's trying to come across as the guru who's got everything sorted in life, and, you know, never have a problem, never miss a 1 foot putt in golf, never, you know, never fail under pressure, all that, you know. It's just unrealistic. So it's far better to come across as like, hey, girl, I'm out there trying my best too, and slipping up from time to time. And yeah. And I think
is that something that you come to understand working in the era of mental skills and psychology? I think there's a lot of people working in your domain that would probably share that idea. It's just very human to be fallible, and the importance of vulnerability and sharing the journey allows people to feel, you know, less pressure when you're trying to help them out. Like, yeah. When did you start to learn that was what it is to be human?
Yeah, and it's just a slow process. I guess you're constantly, I think, even still having to remind myself, but I think you do your study, and you think, I think there's kind of, whether it's conscious or not, this sort of belief that you're kind of going to have all the answers. Like, you know, once I've done sports psychology, I'm going to be a master under pressure, you know, like, it just doesn't work like that. And I think you start to first maybe struggle with, like, oh, you know, maybe I'm not good enough, and I'm not working on myself enough, and I need to be better and all that. And then finally sort of get into that point, that it's going, hang on, this is okay. You know, like, this is actually probably going to be more relatable as a practitioner if you have been through that, and you're not perfect, you're not the guru, you're not always gonna perform when you need to, and you can be more self-accepting of that. I'm sure that's going to help with the way you deliver things. And I think that's just so true for parents. I think parenting as well, as a role model, when we go through stuff, tough stuff as parents, being able to talk even, or even just model that process through your kids of like, hey, I'm going through something pretty hard and maybe I made some mistakes there. And, you know, rather than the alternative is being someone who feels like they need to show that they've got everything sorted in life. And yeah.
Yeah. Is that a central pillar? Like, I'm really interested in your philosophy. There's some research, isn't there, that shows, 70% of the outcomes within sort of those psychological environments where conversations are had from practitioner to athlete or client, that 70% of the outcomes are due to the quality of the relationship.
Yeah, the therapeutic alliance, so to speak. Yeah.
Yeah. It's huge, isn't it? Like, how do you think about that idea?
Yeah, and that's, like, it's kind of tied in with all that, because you feel like, oh, I've done this. I should have these knowledge that I need to, like, give to this person now, and I'm in this position. And that's just so much pressure as well, because you're like, I'm now responsible for giving the answers to this problem right. that this person presents. So when you can actually let go of that, then suddenly you can hear that person in a far better way, and you know, build that relationship and then get better outcomes. But it's, yeah, and I still slip up, you know, like you'll go in and just go like trying to feel like, oh, what would a good sports psychologist say right now? You know, like I just drop, you know, you notice that voice and go, okay, let's let go of that, because like it's not helping me relate to this person sure. right now. And yeah, that's definitely always on my mind, and never perfect at that, but I think it's a far better place to be in terms of focusing on that, like how can we have this a good, honest, vulnerable, open relationship, rather than how can I be in this position of all knowing, all seeing, whatever guru type image that people might have, or that we might.
Yeah, easy to fall into that trap, isn't it? Where
because
I've done the work and I've done the study, all of a sudden I'm the fountain of knowledge, and
totally.
And it's my job to fill you up as a vessel. We all fall into that trap at different times. It's just curious to me as to whether the domain we work in helps us to be more aware of that and less, you know, operating less in that way. And so are there any other values that guide your life? Before we talk specifically to the work that you do, are you a values-driven individual? Do you have real clarity on that and how it underpins your day-to-day?
Yeah, I mean, I sit down and ask people to talk about what they value. So I do have those, I guess, like conversations with myself, I guess. I mean, for me, like, there's several things, like playfulness is one. You can hear that through the jiu-jitsu example.
For sure.
I'm sure.
Yeah, it's coming through.
And when I've coached quite a lot. I was a PE teacher. And for me, you know, I didn't have a great big philosophy. It was just let them play. Didn't mean that I just let them play, you know, like the whole time, but it was the cornerstone of my coaching. And then, you know, when I'm doing group stuff, I always try and have some playful elements and just in my life, like thinking about it. And like, yeah, it's good that you even ask that, because it slips off your mind and you forget, like, how can we play around here? How can we just enjoy the moment and be sort of the primates that we are and play around?
So how do you define play or design environments for play? Because it resonates, because it's a value of mine as well. Exploration and adventure and play. I mean, these are all words that come to mind.
Mm.
But oftentimes I think in our in our youth sport bubble, play can often be thought about as playing the game.
Mm.
So how do you think about play as exploring and trying new things and making mistakes, as opposed to actually just, you know, playing a game of football or playing a game of rugby? And then how do you design for that?
Yeah.
I know this is not one of the questions that I sent prior to the show, but I'm really interested in how you would design an environment that is playful.
Yeah, well, I guess going to the first part of it, defining it, like, for me, it's actually doing something, like, play is something you do for the sake of doing it. Like, the reward is the doing of it, not the outcome at the end. Like, we instrumentalize it, like, oh, play is really good for learning, and play is really good for, you know, I'm really from a place of, like, play is just, like, fun thing to do while we're alive. and so let's play, and so, like, it's for me, it doesn't actually even come from a place of, like, yeah, it's really helpful for learning, yeah, it's helpful for, like I've said, but also we're together, so let's play something. And designing it, going to that part, wow, I don't think I've got the answers there. It's something I really need to think about. I mean, typically I'm always just thinking of, like, a concept, let's say within what I do for work, it's like, okay, well, this is what I want to talk about or teach them about the topic today. How can I sort of make a game around that? How can we sort of play with that? And you're probably going to ask for example, but I'll try and think.
yeah, like I would love to understand how you do that, you know, around ideas like self-awareness, which is a foundational piece for me when it comes to just helping kids to start from a place where they can make change. Because self-awareness, for example, we can write some stuff down in a journal, we can have conversations. The bit that I struggle with is some kids, it doesn't resonate with them yet. The importance of being a little bit introspective is potentially not up for debate. I don't know. Correct me if I'm wrong here. And so what would be a way of playing with that idea to take young people on a journey in a way where it's happening to them and they're getting the benefits? And here I am intellectualizing play, which you just told me we shouldn't be.
Well,
you know, you don't do, but.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, on that, I'm still even giving examples of how I would use it for the benefit, for the purpose of learning. I guess what I don't want to make, I don't want to make play just about, like, a really good way to learn, because then we can't ever play for the sake of play. So I guess I'm passionate about just playing, but also, sure, like, how we can integrate that and use it for something as well. So I don't know. Completely disregard that, but self-awareness stuff, like, yeah, I mean, I'm thinking, like, what I've done, but there's got to be games and related to drama or role-playing, there's, you know, activities I've done where we're sort of just playing around and acting out, exaggerating certain emotions and things that you feel. Let me give you specific examples for that self-awareness one, because that's a really interesting one, given it's such a, like, an internal, I guess, yeah, like that state of mind, that or the way that we think about ourselves and are aware of ourselves is, you have to put into, I guess, the external world and playing with each other. So I don't
know. Is that an idea that you, do you ring fence a self-awareness as a component that you work to specifically, or is it just something that evolves out of doing work with in other areas? So it's probably a good time now to jump into how you think about the mental side of the game, and in particular working with youth, working with young people, because I'm always interested in how working with young people was different to working with adults, and stage of development is a really important piece of the puzzle when it comes to doing this, just understanding how the brain goes on a journey of development and what kids, how they think and feel and how that changes with time. Does this come into your approach at all? And how would you, maybe if we get a little bit more tactile, how would you work with a 12-year-old compared to working with a 20-year-old with a very similar problem? You know, say they're experiencing some performance anxiety, they're getting nervous, their belly's getting upset, perhaps, you know, they're spending half an hour in the bathroom prior to game day. And these are all things that I've spoken to parents about, right? Saturday mornings, literally half an hour in a bathroom prior to getting in the car and going to a game, throwing up, you know, being physically sick, these types of things. And so working with that 12-year-old compared to a 20-year-old, how do you think about approaching that?
Yeah, well, I guess it's just, it can be for me similar frameworks around the approach, but just tailoring that to the where they're at developmentally, like you say. And I wouldn't want time to be an expert on developmental psychology or anything like that. I've experienced working with teenagers my whole life through being a teacher and starting as an adolescent, a 21-year-old teacher and working through, and then even in this stage of my life now working a lot with young athletes. So I'll put that out there first. And I think going back to the 12-year-old, that's that age just starting into those adolescent years, and they're starting to come out from that parental umbrella and look out towards their peer groups and finding that sense of identity and not finding it, sorry, but starting to sort of develop that and think about that. And we mentioned the self-awareness stuff, and I think as a 12-year-old, that's a key part of, like, sometimes I probably wouldn't use the word self-awareness, because sometimes it can be like sort of misinterpreted as, like, people get self-conscious and they think they're being self-aware, right? You know, like, they're wondering about everything that they're doing and overanalyzing it, and then they say, oh, I'm really self-aware. It's a bit different, more than like, okay, how am I, you know, understanding how I feel, why I feel certain things, and also even understanding like my background, who I am, where this comes from. So with a 12-year-old, there's a bit of that psychoeducation, I guess, around like an anxiety, for example, like why has that come up, to try and explain that for them, like what happens in our body. We're interpreting this as a threat. It's like there's a lion just jumped out in front of you, you know, and how are you going to feel there, and explain how, like, why it's a threat now, even though it's not actually a lion, and getting them to understand that, and then coming at it from really a place of, I guess, my framework's based on acceptance and commitment therapy largely, which is about acknowledging and allowing emotions like anxiety to be there, and being able to notice them, self-awareness, being able to let them be there, and then have that space to then direct your attention to fully commit to what's really important to you. So if following that, then we'll talk about what's important to them. The difference between the 12-year-old and the 20-year-old is probably wouldn't go into a deep discussion about values, because they're just still really, as I said, moving out of that parental sort of umbrella to the preteen, the teen years. So it's more about, okay, what's really important to you, and, you know, what do you really want to do there? What sort of person do you want to be? And then trying to get them clear on that, and then going, right, okay, let's see when these feelings come up, this anxiety, how you can find, just live and act in the way that you just said was important to you, the type of person you want to be. Yeah, tricky. Going back to that the relationship, trying to have a little bit of a laugh with them, getting them to chat about things in a fun way, and yeah, it's constant learning for me. It is a hard age group. So then
yeah, it's
carry on. Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, like, there's, for me at least, there's always a, there's a journey of education that sits underneath all of this work, whether it's, you know, helping a young athlete to move better, or in your case, helping them to cope with some feelings a little bit better, or even just to learn a skill like a little bit better. There's an education that kids go on in the classroom, and it would be unlikely for us to expect, you know, someone to do calculus when they haven't really got their ABCs in order yet. Sorry, that was a I just combined a numeracy and a
anyway. Literacy.
But you literacy, I get what I mean.
It was algebra.
Yeah. And so it's those, it is a little bit of scaffolding of their understanding, and coming from a teacher's point of view, which, you know, those concepts are always really clear in front of mind. It's like, how do we insert this here in order to allow understanding and to level up over time?
Yeah.
And I'm just wondering whether there's, you can approach the mental game in this way, or whether it's more of a, there's a problem and we're gonna speak to the problem and try and solve that. And through that comes learning. I had a girl who was just struggling with a little bit of anxiety with her hockey, and we just, it was really interesting. I just trialed the approach of, we're just gonna chat. We're just going to talk about life, and my job is to speak to her about, or reframing some of her experiences in ways that she perhaps hadn't thought of. And that, not because there was a lack of understanding, just because she was young and hadn't yet experienced a wide array of experiences, versus trying to get really specific on scaffolding that learning over time. And so, yeah, I'm sort of curious from your point of view as to whether you, when you're working with young athletes, whether you play it as you see it, or whether you have a particular way of a framework to follow, and, you know, step one, step two, step three. These are the things we need to stick pretty close to, because that's how learning and development happens.
Yeah, I wouldn't say I have a framework in terms of, right, I'm going to lead them through these things, but I have that flexibility. I try to be able to see what, I guess, processes will help get the change, the realistic change that will keep them moving towards, you know, those important things. So those things might come up in terms of how we're managing our thoughts, which would be predominantly more of a acknowledging them, noticing them, seeing them, not letting them drive you around, and for some it might be just being really clear on what's important. For others it might be getting better at catching when they get hooked by a feeling like anger, maybe being able to catch it and notice, I'm feeling anger right now, and that I'm open to using those, I guess, processes where I see fit, and having underlying sure. all of that, like, let's just try and build a connection. It doesn't always, doesn't always happen. I think inevitably some people, probably don't connect with, and it doesn't work. And definitely with youth, it can be more challenging. But I guess the flip side is when you can really build those relationships, and you can see huge change with youth, which is what I'm sure you enjoy and thrive on when working with them. So, yeah.
There's definitely relationships that last a long time. I'm always very aware of when it is time to hand them over. You know, I do believe in this idea of a developmental coach as opposed to a performance coach and a high performance coach, and the skill set is different and the things we need to focus on are different.
Yeah.
And when it comes to some of those, you know, working with those kids, you know, if we were to go and become a better rugby player from a technical point of view, then there's a lot of practice that is required. You know, they need to go and do the work and get the reps in, be it playful or being more structured. So how do those reps show up in your world? I'm assuming that the same underlying mechanisms for getting better is required, like the practices.
Yeah,
is something that is required, and I think that's easily forgotten when it comes to the mental side of the game.
Totally, yeah.
And so how do you get kids to engage with that idea of this needs to be an omnipresent idea in your day-to-day if you want it to get better?
That's, yeah, I mean, such a good point, because it's like the thing that really, I think, the youth more so relate to in terms of like, hey, you know, like we want to get stronger or whatever, we do these repetitions and it happens. And framing it like that is really beneficial. So like if I talk to you through like, you know, a young rugby player, for example, a common one might be he's had an injury, he's had a concussion, he's had something, and he's just lost his tackling confidence. And so the parent or, you know, even the athlete or coach might seek me out and say, we need to build this confidence back up. And immediately the player's already like, God, I need this confidence, you know. And what I'd do there is we sort of reframe it and go, well, we're actually looking for moments of when you don't have it, but you still can move forward and go for it. So that, you know, we're not waiting around for this feeling that might not show up, and then let's keep score. So every time you feel like hesitating, not making the tackle, your body says no, your confidence is, your self-talk's negative, and you hear all that, and then you move forward and go for it anyway, we'll give you a point. That's one confidence point. And then just play those sorts of games, and it can really like make it transfer it from a sort of abstract world to like, oh yeah, okay, I just need to, like, when I feel that, it sounds pretty raw, like just get it. It's not like just, you just gotta feel it and go for it, you know, but it's done from a place of like compassion from their point of view, like, okay, it's okay that you don't have that confidence, and we'll talk all about that and understand that, and understand that your mind's doing this, and be okay with that, and compassionate and kind towards yourself about that, but then able to sort of take that step forward, and however small it is, you know, you get a point, and then count those points. And I've had, you know, numerous, actually that specific example, numerous times where they'll come back, go, 6 points. And you go, well done. Like we're not celebrating the success of the tackle, the outcome, the whatever. It's just, wow, you felt something really hard that you had to deal with, and you didn't let it boss you around. You didn't let it control what you did. You took a step forward, and we'll celebrate that. And so it's, yeah, going back to those repetitions and making the progress a different sort of game. And that seems to really work well with young people. They like that. It's kind of taking the mystical world of the mind and putting it into some plain behavioral sort of actions, you know, like it's simple. And it's not saying
it's, yeah, everyone. And it talks to stage of development as well, where the ability to think abstractly is somewhat determined by their experiences in life. You know, it's like you hear, you know, an adult that will go and seek out some support because of some things that they're experiencing, and there's a lot of life to draw on. And so you can sit in a room and have a conversation and make sense of the world by just joining some dots. Or it seems to me that that's more possible than doing that with a 12-year-old, where there's just not enough dots and that have been created in order to join those pieces. And so you're almost having to create the dots as you go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, super interesting. But it makes sense to create a concrete way of actually moving somebody forward like that, and assuming that you've got the relationship and they're willing to dive into the unknown, almost for you more than anything, really, isn't it?
Yeah. And making sure that, I guess, not to downplay the normalizing those their internal experience first, and not discrediting that and being like, yeah, just ignore that and just go, you know, like it's not that.
Sure.
I'm not saying that. And I guess it could be misinterpreted that way. So it's more like, okay, when, you know, those feelings come up, when we allow them and normalize them and understand why they're there, then they can then go, okay, and now I know what I'm going to do, because I've noticed it and caught it. And yeah.
I mean, I first came across your work through, I think, the Mental Toughness Journal that you put out into the world a little while ago. What was the genesis of that idea? Because that's a physical resource that young people can use to work on their mental game.
Yeah.
And And so how did you think about putting that together, and what are the aspects of that that you think are really helpful?
Well, I guess I started doing, not long after I finished my master's in sports psych, and, you know, I did an applied program. I wanted to get stuck in and do some work. And obviously you can't just rock up at the local high performance center and go, oh, man, you know, there's no. And so I naturally, having been a teacher, wanted to do some work with young people, and felt comfortable in that area, and started off doing some stuff in schools, but actually did my internships and practice in high school as well. So in secondary school volleyball, and was part of their programs. And then, so yeah, created these 4-week workshops. Probably should have been six, but they were, you know, those short 4-week workshops called Resilience, for youth sport resilience. And they did about 15 or so, I think, in over 3 years. We had over 400 kids go through them, and just basically through that, obviously adapting and changing that content. But I had the stuff there that I felt like worked for the kids that I worked with, and had requests for resources and things. And actually, it's quite funny that the ultimate catalyst was my wife brought home some journal from Happy Life journal. It was an app for adults. And I was sort of looking through and I was going, oh, I could do something like this. Quite cynically, like, I could do better than this. And literally it was like 2 weeks later I'd written it based off the resilience program content. So it wasn't like I had to, you know, recreate anything. And then it's not a huge amount in the book. It's designed for them to be able to read through 65 pages, which aren't full normal size text or anything like that. But they read through that. There's some questions, exercises, reflections, and then obviously space for them to write. It's important that we write still with pens, even though that's been phased out. I think it is important, and it gets us off our phones or computers. So, yeah, it's something like, I guess people have said also, why isn't it an app? Because, well, it's everyone's got an app, and I don't actually think reflection is a good thing to do on a computer or a phone. So if you want to be reflective, you want to take your book and go to some place in the house where there's no screens and things like that. So yeah, that was kind of all the reasons why the book was created, and it guides them through three principles really about learning how to stay present, and in that being really aware and noticing how you're feeling, emotions, how you're acting, those sorts of things, being reflective, having clear sort of values and goals, and at least thinking about them, and then encouraging, courageous, like using courage as the theme, and being brave and doing things, committing to doing things that are important to you. However small, and pretty simple, straightforward, and I self-published it, not a marketer or anything like that, but it's sold 3,000 now, which is pretty proud of. That's
super cool. And I mean, you discount it as being super simple, but I think it's incredibly powerful, and I'd love to dig a little bit more into those three principles, and for you to perhaps provide some examples or some stories from, obviously without, you know, talking to names or anything, but it aligns to the approach, doesn't it, of being able to be present enough to recognize what's showing up.
And then
taking those and using them to create some action points based on what it is that you're...
Mm.
You want to do and who it is that you want to be. And so it starts with reflecting on experiences.
It actually sort of probably is not how it starts. I start with the thinking about who you are and your values, and a little bit around even like going back to like your ancestry and that sense of like belonging that people can get from that. Their whakapapa, their, you know, like their all their family history is kind of cool. And I think that's actually something I did during my study. We had to do that, and I found it really, really powerful in terms of talking to my parents about my grandparents and their parents and all that, and learning about history. So there's a bit of that in there to start off.
So what are some of the values? I give an example of the values. I had Owen Eastwood on, and he talked about this, and he's obviously got that great book, and it's becoming really a more and more of a thing that people are speaking to, and in particular, you know, drawing on our Māori heritage. And like, I really enjoy moving towards this idea, but what comes out of that? Like, what are you seeing kids do and start to talk about? And are they changing the stories of themselves and the things that they're wanting to do based on talking about their whakapapa?
Yeah, and it's addressing not so much, I even wouldn't call it a value, or you might call it a universal human value, but really like a psychological need to belong. And that, like, we know that's dropping off. I saw a study the other day in terms of sense of belonging in young people, and like the graphs are all heading down, and so like that, like, oh, actually I'm connected to this, like Owen Eastwood would describe it better. It was him that probably inspired that part of the journal for me. But that connection to something, so I'm connected to and I belong to this, and then through that I have some sort of like foundation in terms of who I am, and that gives me then the ability, as it says in the book, like to know that I'm not the outcome. So when I go out and feel like who I am is a good rugby player, then I'm really connected to being a good rugby player in that moment. So I will ride the roller coaster of those results and then really, really feel that pressure. Whereas if I'm like, no, I'm, you know, I know who I am. I come from this and I come from that, and my fuck-up is this and whatever. And this result, although important and although might be upsetting if it doesn't go my way, is not a catastrophic sort of failure in me living up to my identity.
So it really draws on that idea.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it draws on that idea of this is what I do, not who I am.
Yeah, that sort of stuff.
About a lot.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Going back to that. Mm. Yeah.
So, and will they talk specifically? Will the, you know, when they talk about what they belong to, will they dig into some of the teams that they're involved in, or do you direct them more to family heritage and whakapapa, as you spoke to?
Well, look, I mean, this for me, the journal is like for them to have those discussions, and then it will move on towards like their own sort of like, I guess, their own personal values of like who they are and like what things, starting to think about what's important to them. So if I was working through this with someone, which doesn't happen as much, you know, like I said, I might take certain parts of the book as the processes that I see needed for that person, but not work them through the whole thing. That sense of belonging, I think, is always, as you'd know, like it's always got to be on front of mind. Like, are they, you know, do they feel like they belong? Have that connection, you know, that self-determination stuff is always a good foundation. Do they, you know, they feel like they're getting better, they feel competence. And if they've got that autonomy and they feel like they've got that drive, then that, you know, that those needs, I guess, are either met or maybe they're not, and there's an area that we could focus on there. So you're using those, you mentioned the team stuff, like, yeah, if that's a really big part of their belonging and you can assess that, then that's cool as well. Like, you know, okay, they've got a connection there, they've got a community, they've got that relatedness. And, yeah.
Cool. Mm. And so when it comes to learning to be present more, do you have particular tools that you draw on from that point of view? Like, obviously mindfulness has become fairly popular in the modern day. Like, do you push them towards trying a suite of things and figuring out what's right for them, or how do you think about helping kids to be more present apart from getting off their phones.
I know. Well, it is tricky because it becomes like the trendy thing. And then, you know, I think a lot of the mindfulness stuff is presented in the wrong way as like some sort of magic tool to make life easy or without suffering or, you know, something like that. Like, this will fix you. So I try and, I don't use the M word now as much. Young people don't care either. Like, they've probably heard, they did mindfulness in primary school now, so it's like they'll roll their eyes at that. So yeah, there's various techniques in there. Like, a lot of it is, I talk about, like, sometimes, you know, like, even like we get hooked by feelings. So let's talk about, like, last time they were hooked, you know, and anger like got them, and like, how can we unhook from that? And I guess the mindfulness is that, is noticing like, oh, I'm being hooked here by this feeling that's kind of got me, and it's kind of a sense of like unhooking, or at least stepping back a bit and noticing it. So talking about that, situations, and these exercises in the book, like surfing through your feelings, like just being able to sit and notice a feeling come up like a wave. Don't have a forceful sort of way of trying to get rid of it, but notice it come, notice it wash away, or whatever it does. And then other exercises, which still mindful, but like really noticing even just the external environment, noticing, just getting better at noticing, really. It's not always actually where we'd, probably often with kids, it would start with the more behavioral stuff, and get into make those commitments like we talked about earlier. But in the book, there's definitely lots of ways for them to give it a go. I've just checked, I think there's 5 or 6 just different exercises they can use to try and get more present. And it's an ongoing process as well. But ultimately, if you can notice anger, for example, the common one, or nerves, you can go, oh, yep, there it is. And maybe that relationship with it isn't so automatic and driven by those feelings.
Yeah. It's super powerful, I think. It's something that all our young people should be. Should be probably the wrong way of talking about it, but it would be lovely for them to be exposed to this in their everyday at school or in their sporting environments, because it obviously sets them up for a life better lived, arguably, if they can do that. I remember walking along with my kids when they were really young, and we went outside, out of the fence, headed along to the playground. Dad, can we go for a play? Cool. We just live down the road. It's not a very long walk. But we go up this alleyway of trees and flowers, and we're walking along there, and my 4 or 5 year old, I can't remember how old she was at the moment, just constantly noticing things that I'm just oblivious to. The beautiful thing, I think, about childhood, at least, is that ability to be present is so clear in the formative years, and then life just kind of gets in the way, doesn't it? Like, all of a sudden we start to get distracted and get told that there's certain boxes we need to tick or certain outcomes we need to reach, and all of a sudden we no longer have the ability to pick up. She'd pick up the most beautiful flower sitting on that had just fallen off the tree. That ability to notice things in nature, I think, is something that we lose with time. So yeah, somehow drawing them back to being childlike again is a cool thing to do. What about that idea of being more courageous? I mean, you gave us a bit of an example around that rugby player and noticing how he's feeling and choosing to do it anyway. Are there specific tools or activities that you get kids to do that helps them move towards being more courageous?
Yeah, well, I've got an interesting list that I show with words on most of the workshops I do with youth and coaches as well. Like, it's just got 2 sides. Words on the left, words on the right. Words on the left are like shaky, nervous, worried, fearful. Words on the right are like confident, carefree, unworried, that sort of thing. And I ask the kids, like, who's the brave one here? Like which one's more courageous? And they'll always say, well, it's the one who's carefree and confident and all that. And then I'll sort of say, well, how, tell me about that. Why is that? Why are they brave? And I'm like, because they're going to be able to do that stuff. And then you sort of can uncover that barrier is there. Like, well, actually, that's easy when we're confident. That doesn't mean we're brave because you're doing it. You're already confident. You're not feeling the fears. You're not doing all that. So, it's amazing that you've always choose that side. The message is often like, the brave person's the one who doesn't feel anything. Well, it's not the
Yeah, right.
case, like, and I'll get up the definition on the computer and be like, well, this is what it says about courage. It's about like if you're fearful and you're still able to do the right thing. And so then suddenly, like, that's the challenge is like suddenly that can we flip that feeling that you're getting into an opportunity to be to do something pretty important and brave rather than something that we just need to get rid of so that we can then start being courageous. So it doesn't work like that. However we go about it's like, wow, these are these little opportunities in life where you can go, well, I'm feeling something right now. Maybe it's because it's really important to me. Maybe that means I'm gonna, I need to go and do this and do the brave thing right now. So flipping that feeling of, I'm sure you've heard people talk about that with the example of pressure in sports, but I think it's like for young people, it's like how many times you put up your hand in class and answered a question, even though you're not, you don't know you got whether it's right or wrong. Did you take a stab at it? Did you that sort of thing. And for some, that's such a hard thing to do. And it's like, well, that if you did that, that's hugely brave. That's, just because that's not running into battle, charging, to whatever people think of courage. For you, it is brave, And for some, it might be just getting out of bed and going to school. Like whatever it is, reframing that courage to be something within their world that's a little bit challenging, but it's important to them and they can see those as opportunities. So that's why for me, like probably you can probably hear like very behavioral and how I work with them. Like let's take these steps, let's commit to these and let's keep score and let's see how you're going. And so that's how I go about it, really like making sure they understand what we mean by courage and being brave and that seeing that as little opportunities to go and practice it. And that's why in there's a little bank. They put it in. There's like a brave bank in the journal and they just write down all the things I've done that they think were brave and courageous. And I think it's important that they don't think of that as whether other people would think it brave because everyone's in their own little battle, their own little world. So,
I love it. I'm thinking about appropriate challenge. This is it's a key idea in my framework of creating environments. And because one of the levers that I pull on a lot is how we design environments, and the appropriate challenge is a really important idea. And you spoke to that beautifully around what's actually not what we think is the right challenge for the individual. It's actually how they perceive it. And getting the right challenge in order to step them towards being brave, I think, is where the magic lies. Because a step, it can always be a step too far. Like we may perceive it as being doable, but it's a step too far for them. And so, do you think about appropriate challenge? Like, how do you work with an individual to find out what it is that they are willing to do with a little bit of support? You know, it's that idea of proximal development in the educational speak, right? Because if they're sitting in class and we've had a conversation about the importance of feeling, that yucky tummy, but putting their hand up anyway, but that's a step too far. Are there other options? Like, how do you think about appropriate challenge?
That's so important. Like traditionally, exposure therapy would create the hierarchy. You'd start at the you'd create that with the client, the hierarchy of like the steps of intensity of emotion that comes up when you do each of those things. And that's really I think I've tried that with the kids and I just find it really hard. So there's a bit of like they're just like, oh, I don't know, like, give this a rating and all that. I just leave it, and I just think of like some things, try and ask them like, what's, you know, say like it is the public speaking one, like they talk about, you know, kids who want to be better leaders, their sports team maybe, and they want to speak a bit more or whatever. And then I just challenge them to think of some opportunities where they could just take a little bit of initiative and have a go at speaking, even though that they might be being pulled by a feeling to avoid it. I guess that's the tricky one. It's just trying to figure out like, where do you just start suggesting and stop if they can't come up with things. But ultimately you want them to come up with, okay, well, what's a little step forward. Actually, what I do sometimes is I'll talk about like, hey, so if we're talking about, let's talk about anger, for example, like when anger's got control of you, careful not to say when you are, you know, angry, but when anger's there, we'll externalize it. We'll say, when anger's got control of you, what are some ways that you don't like behaving, and what are some things that you've done? And then they'll explore like some of the sort of behaviors that they're not proud of and that don't fit well with who they want to be. And then going, okay, well, let's see, when might anger come up again? Like maybe just a little bit. I might say, oh, maybe someone calls me a name, someone says something in a cricket match. Okay, cool. So we know that might come up. Let's talk about then how you might like respond to that. And I think it's still, for me, it's still courage, because even though it's like people think of fear and courage, it's like, no, it's the feeling wants you to do something. And so we'll talk about, hey, what's the courageous way that you could act there when that feeling comes up. Yeah. So I don't know if it's true. It sort of answers that question, but that conversation
Yeah,
about
no,
like really digging deep about when they've acted how they didn't want, and then trying to uncover like what's a sort of small one that you could go and do.
No, that frame up's really helpful. And I think that almost preloading some of those intentions is really, really beneficial, because oftentimes, at least in youth sport, I think it's changing in elite sport now. It was always trying to solve the problem. Like, oh, I'm already here in the space where I'm fearful of performing X skill, or I'm already feeling this anxiety about going into this particular environment. And now let's try and create the courage in order to walk into that challenge. But at the moment, it's just a step too far. And so finding context in which you can almost bank courage away from the problem in question potentially could be really powerful. And I always look for those, you know, vehicles to build courage away from the context of the, and I it's debatable whether or not that courage is transferable. I'd be interested in your thoughts. I think it's somewhat dependent on stage development. Yeah, definitely it's a super interesting space. Like, do you have any suggestions for starting to implement some of the stuff into the world of the sports coach? Like, what would you start with if you were to talk to a coach about, hey, we got to start taking our kids on this journey of helping them to work with their emotions? Like, start here.
I guess what I think this was related to that, but really, I think what coaches continually, sounds harsh, get wrong, is that they want everyone to feel good, everything to go well, everything to look good, and then they can go home happy from training. You know, like, and that doesn't obviously happen like that. And you know, you're from that physical standpoint, you might agree, like, we need to not just prescribe stuff at training that looks good. We need to challenge, we need to have a bit of chaos, we need to have them responding to things that are wrong. And I think there's a little bit of that as well emotionally, and in terms of like not being, you're not deliberately bringing up stuff to make people feel certain ways, but you're allowing that to happen, and rather than avoiding it and covering it up. Because as a coach or a parent, when, you know, someone feels something and we try and cover it up, dismiss it with some sort of toxic sort of positivity, you know, like good vibes only, guys, you know, like that just crushes any opportunity for us to learn about the emotions. And, you know, like, so there's moments, I'm sure, in trainings and games where people feel certain things, and the natural desire of the coach is going to be, God, I just want everyone to feel better, and I just want everyone to be happy, and I just want us to get, you know. But, like, is there enough
turn? I think that's very human, isn't it?
Yeah. Oh, that's everyone, yeah.
It's the same with a parent. I mean, my mind goes to plenty of occasions where, like, oh, just fix it, Craig.
Yeah. Just get them, I'll get them an ice cream. but, look, and then, it's just got to be careful. Like, we're all well-intentioned, and coaches as well, and I think it's just the same for parents. But there's an opportunity there for them to learn the ability to recognize how they feel. And so a coach that pulls in and goes, okay, like, what's going on right now for you all? And then whether they have the opportunity or courage to say that, and then be able to say, well, this is what I see. Now that must be pretty tough. And notice that, you know, you're not trying to deny it or fix them straight away, eh? And then even if it's just that, you've taught them that you've seen it, we've allowed it to be there, it's okay. We're much healthier than avoiding and dismissing those feelings. Yeah, it's a great question in terms of the pause at the start, because I don't have, like, I'm still trying to formulate, like, what would be the best way for coaches to do that. And it's hard, man. I've gone into coaching, when was the last time I coached? Maybe a couple of years ago, and you sort of have these ideas, but you just get swept away with all the other stuff, what they think they need.
Yeah, there's a narrative that comes with coaching that I think we need to challenge. And it moves to a couple of questions. I'm conscious of your time and the need to go and pick your kids up. So I've got two questions just to start wrapping this one up. So the first one being, when you hear the words balance, what comes to mind? And the reason I've got that question in there is, you know, we're talking a lot about balance at the minute. Sport New Zealand have the Balance is Better campaign. Everybody wants things to be in balance. So I'm just curious how you think about that idea.
The first thing word that comes to mind is impossible, but but that might not be the case. That's a cynical mind. And then I just think of, like, it's more of that seesaw that's always moving rather than one that just stands there statically and is perfectly balanced all the time. We're kind of swinging back and forth, trying to, I feel like, maintain the, well, we should be maintain, we should sort of maintain that, those parts of our life that we need to and want to and are important to us. But it's definitely not a, mate, it's your, I should have just flicked that back to you, the balance.
every time I have this conversation, my thinking changes a little bit in formulating this idea of, it's funny, I now think about balance in the way that I think about skill acquisition, and the new ideas around skill acquisition is the ability to be present and respond to the environment. And the ability to do that is the ability to see and to make good decisions and to be discernful. The more and more I do this, the more I think the ability to, and it dovetails a lot into the work that you're doing, is to understand and be present in the environment, and then based off what you're perceiving, work to actually move in a direction of meaning. So yeah, that's sort of, that's a bit of a random kind of dump of ideas, but that's where I'm trying to move to, as opposed to this very, concrete way of doing a little bit of this and I do a little bit of this and do a little bit of this and having balance. I think you can do one sport incredibly well, and if that environment allows for all of the key nutrients of health and happiness, then, and you're teaching the kid to be able to to work within that environment from a skillful point of view, then I think it can be really healthy. So
yeah, I think
still
it's
still trying to figure that one out.
And that's it. It's just got to be so nuanced, and you know, there can't be an answer for everybody. It's like everyone's got that question, I guess, is the best thing. Like, how are you going in terms of fulfilling things that you want to fill in your life, rather than like having any sort of preconception about what a balanced life looks like? Because it's just like, you know, what the people were, just neurodiversity and different cultures and all sorts of stuff at play that can influence how happy someone is and what they're doing. And I think, yeah, no, ultimately the question is for that person individually, not for anyone to know what.
Yeah. Oh, and I think that speaks to this idea of athlete-centered, an athlete-centered approach, which I don't believe we're doing very well. I think we've academicized it, if that's even a word. But we haven't actually spent much time trying to figure out what it looks like in practice. But I think the idea of balance that we're moving towards is actually about helping the young person to, you know, like some of the stuff you talk to, understand who they want to be and what's important to them, and then just nudging them, helping them move in the direction of that, living true to that, which is...
Yeah, how they want to spend their life. Like, that's ultimately all we've got is, you know, our time. And one question I ask about some kid who wants to be a or that or whatever it is, and I go, okay, well, let's say you try that for the next 10 years and you don't achieve it, are you still going to be happy with how you've spent that time? You know, so it can indicate like, well, actually, it's just all about whether I make it or not. And that might indicate that for them, yeah, maybe there's a balanced conversation there. But like, yeah, guys, that's what I asked with the social media workshop I did recently, just making sure they knew how much time we spend on it and just asking that question. How do you want to spend your time?
Yeah, powerful question. when you spend some time talking about it, this is the other thing I don't believe we do enough of, not wanting to end this pod too negatively,
open it,
but
end it.
Yeah, you know, just like having time where we're spending some of our conversation on some of the stuff that potentially is more meaningful than whether or not we win the game or not.
Yeah.
And creating space to do that and just being a little bit more reflective on our lives. Anyways, Zane, one more question before we before we knock this on the head. So in your mind, what is youth sport for?
I didn't have a good think about this, but there's so much stuff that must, you know, that goes through your head, doesn't it? Like, oh, it's about developing people and growing into, you know, all of that. And it's just for the parents, really, isn't it? That's a joke. like what I'm thinking a lot about is like, is childhood really just like traineehood for adulthood? Does it have to be like that? Like, can't we just have experience in youth sport that's great and good as it is, not because it's a pathway to be an All Black or be a top gymnast or whatever? Can't we just like enjoy youth sport and for the beauty that it is to see, you know, our young people out there moving, playing, having fun, learning about themselves, learning to cooperate with others, get along and all those things, but not prescribe it in a way that is like, well, that we only do this because we want them to be this, a champion, a gold medalist, or whatever. So like, taking away that, I think youth sport's just going back to that playfulness and treating it not as a training ground for adulthood, but more of just an expression of their youth and their vitality and being able to play and enjoy life and as only a young person can with a young body.
Zane, on that note, we will pick that up in our next conversation, because there's a lot of there's a lot of juice in that one. But kia ora, I appreciate you taking the time coming on the show. It's been super fun. And yeah, we'll stay in touch. And we'll share the link to your journal in the notes. So anybody out there who's listening in, go check it out, get yourself a copy, and yeah, get in front of some young people.
Cheers, mate. Thanks. It's great to be on here with you.